This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
What came first, life on Earth or oxygen on Earth? It might depend on what type of life you're talking about, but understanding how oxygen got here might go a long way towards explaining how we got here.
Yeah, definitely it ties to the origin of humans, the origin of animals, because all multicellular organisms like us and like animals require oxygen.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, our astrobiology series returns with a look at the search for the origins of oxygen on Earth and how that might lead to more clues about the origins of life. We'll also spend an academic minute looking for water beneath the surface of Mars. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Most of us learned that we need oxygen to breathe and survive long before we took our first science class. But have you ever wondered where oxygen came from and how it ended up in our atmosphere? Dr. Ariel Anbar has. Dr. Anbar is a biogeochemist in the Department of Chemistry at the School of Earth and Science Exploration at Arizona State University. He specializes in studying the origin of oxygen on our planet. And if you track down the origins of oxygen, you're on a pretty clear path towards the origins of life. Dr. Anbar recently spoke with the Best of Our Knowledge's science reporter David Gustina about his work starting with the Anoxic Archean. It's part of our astrobiology series on the origins of life.
Anoxic Archean, huh?
Sometimes we have trouble understanding ourselves as scientists, too. So, I mean, no joke. I mean, I know what those words mean, but I'm talking to a room full of scientists, you know, very scholarly, erudite people. Half of them don't know what some of those words are either.
So explain.
Sure. So geologists like to divide Earth history into different periods of time, and we give those different periods of time names. And the Archean is the name that we give to roughly the first half of Earth history. So the Anoxic Archean is referring to the first half of Earth history. Anoxia refers to the amount of oxygen that's around. And we think that during that first half of Earth history, there was very little free oxygen, the O2 molecule that you and I breathe in order to live. We think that there's very little O2 in the environment during the Archean. So it's referred to as a period of anoxia.
Got it. And I would assume that since you're looking at oxygen in this period, it directly relates to that question I started with. The origins of life, or how did the Earth evolve and eventually human life evolve?
Yeah, definitely it ties to the origin of humans, the origin of animals, because all multicellular organisms like us and like animals require oxygen in large amounts in the environment.
In fact, we are animals, aren't we? Parents don't like it when you tell their kids that they're animals.
We don't need to go there if you don't want to, but yes, we are.
But we are animals.
So the rise of animals on the Earth is only possible because large amounts of oxygen accumulated in the atmosphere, and that happened beginning around 2.5 billion years ago. The Earth underwent a transformation that led inevitably to the, or maybe not inevitably, that's what we don't know. Inexorably, though, it led to the environment that we have today.
So a couple of things out of that. You know, you have oxygen that is now on the planet and whiffs, as you describe it. How did it get there? What happened? Are we talking about photosynthesis? What are we talking about that caused this oxygen to appear? And then the idea that this wasn't just a continuous rise necessarily, there are up and down periods, I would say.
Right. So this current research that we're doing and have been doing the last few years, looking at this period of time, this anoxic Archean, when there wasn't much oxygen around, looking for evidence that it was being produced, even though it wasn't accumulating in the environment. So we were looking for evidence of whiffs of oxygen being produced by photosynthesis in the environment at that time. And one of the big puzzles is, if there was oxygen being produced at that time, why didn't it accumulate in the atmosphere? And so one piece of investigating that puzzle is to look for evidence of whiffs of oxygen during that era.
And what would cause it to leave?
Well, so oxygen is a very reactive gas. The reason that we use it for energy is because oxygen will react with compounds, we call them organic carbon compounds, or what you eat for essentially, and give you a lot of energy. So oxygen is a very reactive gas, and it will react with all sorts of things that you wouldn't normally think of as food, like the iron in your car, right? Your car rusts because oxygen is reacting with the iron metal to make what we call iron oxide. So oxygen gets consumed by all sorts of chemical reactions in the environment, including reactions with compounds like iron, elements like iron that are in rocks, compounds that are coming out from volcanoes that are reactive with oxygen. So there's a whole host of things that consume oxygen as well as to counterbalance the production of oxygen.
So there's all this synthesis that's going on as oxygen is interacting with various things.
That's right. And there's this dynamic balance between oxygen production and oxygen consumption. And somehow that balance changed around 2.5 billion years ago. And that's the big puzzle. Why did it change?
Well, this is fascinating stuff. Now, before we go further with this, I want to back up a little bit because As I understand it, you arriving at your present position in life was quite natural. It runs in the family.
Yeah, I'm an academic brat. My father was an academician. He's still with us, but he's retired. He was a professor at SUNY Buffalo, was chair of the biophysics department, beginning in 1977. Brought us to upstate New York, actually.
And that's where you made a very big discovery as a young man. You cracked open a rock and not with your head.
Yeah, well, it wasn't a big discovery in the scheme of things, but it was a moment of epiphany for me. I was in college, actually, and on a geological field trip to upstate New York. It was my second geology class. I was trying to decide what I wanted to major in. Chemistry, geology, or psychology, actually, was the other thing I was thinking about majoring in. And we're on this field trip and cracked open this rock and saw these fossils. And I realized that I was the first living thing in hundreds of millions of years to gaze on these things. And that was one of these sort of moments that, you know, everyone hopefully has at some point in their lives where you say, wow, wait a minute. And you start thinking about things a little differently. And that was a big moment.
And what was this fossil?
It was a layer of rock that had in it many, many fossils of what we call brachiopods.
Brachiopods?
Yes. They're little shelly organisms that live in the ocean.
So this was a giant sea at one point, right?
Most of the earth
was covered in water. And this would have been an organism that swam around in the sea.
This region, yes. And these lived on the seafloor, but yes.
Do we know what they lived on?
They were very much like seashell-type organisms you would find today. I mean, they ate organic carbon just like you and I do, and they breathed oxygen. They weren't old enough to be living at a time when there wasn't oxygen.
Wow.
So, and they couldn't have lived because they were animals. So these are organisms that could only have existed after there was a lot of oxygen in the environment.
So as you begin to study how the Earth has evolved, as you examine these whiffs of oxygen, obviously enough oxygen arrives to promote all this synthesis and all this development, eventually animal life. Do we have any agreement now as to whether that evolved out of the sea?
The general thinking is that life evolved in the sea and moved out from there. You know, if you scratch the surface of that argument, there's not a whole lot to it, actually, which is kind of intriguing.
How so?
Well, the reality is most of the ancient rocks we have are from the sea. They get preserved. Rocks that are deposited on land get weathered away very quickly and don't get preserved as easily. And so that argument is really built on the absence of a record on land, but you don't really know what was there, right?
And you like to work off of evidence.
Well, we as scientists like to work off of evidence. Like anybody else, though, we work off of the evidence that we have, and that tends to lead to certain opinions and certain assumptions based on the evidence you've got. But there are some scientists out there. I have a colleague at ASU, actually, who thinks that actually some of the big evolutionary advances probably happened on land and radiated from land to the sea. And, you know, it's a very hard thing to test as a problem.
Well, and we also know, and this, I think, may go against some of the arguments when it comes to what is necessary for life, is that even on our own planet, some of the vents at the bottom of the ocean and even in some acidic lakes and other things, we find organisms that are alive. So, you know, and I know you're doing work with astrobiology and NASA. You lead the astrobiology unit at your at ASU. But, you know, when I've talked to scientists who study exoplanets and other places in the solar system, what keeps coming back is we may not know all the conditions under which life can exist. And therefore, perhaps oxygen was important here, but it might not be the only substance where life can exist or be a catalyst for life.
Sure. Well, we certainly know that you can have life without oxygen. The production of oxygen is a byproduct of one particular type of life, photosynthetic organisms. And life has evolved, other forms of life have evolved to take advantage of the energy that exists once you have oxygen in the environment that can react with other things. But there are plenty of organisms that exist in the absence of oxygen. They're all microbes, though. To get complex multicellular organisms, as far as we know, you need oxygen because those kind of organisms need a lot of energy, and no one has come up with a particularly good idea of how you would naturally, what kind of natural environment you would have that could give you enough energy to fuel complex organisms without oxygen. But that doesn't mean it doesn't happen out there. And one of the big breakthroughs really in the last 20, 30 years, in the past generation, has been the discovery, at least when it comes to microbes, that the diversity of ways that organisms can make a living is far more dramatically different and weird than anybody had thought before.
Well, we spoke to a scientist who was studying microbes on a space mission to see, because we all have different combinations of microbes in our own body, and to see how those microbes could improve and maintain the health of astronauts if they were to go to Mars.
Right. Well, there's certainly that. You have more microbial cells in your body than you have human cells. I mean, you are a big carrier for the microbes that live in your gut.
Ooh.
Yeah. Well, that's the reality of it. You're a symbiote. You may not realize it, but you live in symbiosis with all this huge microbial community inside of you. And some of those microbes live in conditions that you would consider rather extreme, right? And what we found is in the environment in general, you mentioned acidic lakes, deep sea vents, all these places have microbial life in it that exists in conditions that when you and I were little kids, the most erudite scientists of those eras would have said, well, no, those aren't. Those are going to be sterile environments. But they aren't. There is no sterile environment on Earth, just about.
No. And in fact, our advance in medicine pretty much came when we realized we needed to wash our hands.
Well, that certainly helps, yes.
Well, so I hate to turn it in this direction, but you brought it up in an article I read. You're a Trekkie, aren't you?
I am a Star Trek fan, yeah. I was a very big Star Trek fan as a kid. Well, classic Star Trek.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. And I know that you even will spend a little time with your children watching some episodes at times.
Sure.
But you know, it made me think of something as you were talking there for a moment. You know, often in these Star Trek episodes, we see how far advanced they are. You know, we're going to planet such and such in Vector 3, and it has... Do you see a day when, like, you're sort of looking at the evolution of Earth, that we will advance to the point we start cataloging planets and ways in which they evolve, you know, literally getting it down to that kind of a science? Can you imagine a day when that could be true?
Sure. I mean, we're in a sense doing that right now. We are cataloging all the planets that are being discovered right now as we speak by the Kepler telescope and other efforts to look for planets outside our solar system. There are now thousands known, and we're cataloging them, and we're trying very hard to figure out how we can take the next step of figuring out what those planets are like. And what drives much of that is to try to figure out how we could look for evidence of life on those planets.
Still to come, David Gustina's conversation with Dr. Ariel Anbar continues with a look at our limitations. After all, we're only human. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1211. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Dr. Ariel Anbar, a biogeochemist in the Department of Chemistry at the School of Earth and Science Exploration at Arizona State University. He's speaking with The Best of Our Knowledge's science reporter David Gustina about his work searching for the origins of oxygen on Earth as part of our astrobiology series on the origins of life.
Is the best tool in the scientist's arsenal to recognize that he or she is limited by their human perception and that they have to be prepared to receive the unexpected?
The history of space exploration definitely is that nature surprises us, and that's true in science in general. And almost at every turn, nature surprises us. I think if you are a scientist engaged in really exploring the frontiers, you can't help but be humble at a certain level, because you come up with theories and ideas and you think you know what you're going to find, and oh, well, that's a little different than that, or a lot different than that. And that's part of the fun of it, actually. People like to think that scientists are know-it-alls sometimes. You know, there's this kind of perception.
No.
And that scientists are disappointed when their theories turn out to be incorrect. Actually, there's no bigger thrill in many ways for a scientist than to be totally surprised by something, because that means there's something completely new to try to understand.
I mean, Euripides, he sat in the bathtub and he discovered buoyancy. He said, "Eureka, I found it." So, you know, this is all about many times being surprised and maybe the unexpected coming through in your work. And I love the way you put that, that scientists really do embrace that.
Right.
I noticed, of course, that when I introduced you, that you are a biogeochemist. And one of the things that we notice in university settings is that they separate things by subject.
Mm-hmm.
So you got the biologist and the geologist.
Right. It's one of the big problems in science and in teaching.
Let's talk about that, because...
Sure. Near and dear to my heart.
I think what's really important here is you see in your own title that none of these things are separated in the natural world.
Nature doesn't care about these categories.
That's
these
right.
are categories we've invented to help organize things for our limited brains.
So collaborate, yes?
Yes, and it's very tough because we organize these things around certain disciplines because it's convenient in certain ways. It's convenient for teaching. It's convenient for organizing research. But the problems that really interest us often transcend those boundaries. And those structures that we create them based on what we think are the important problems at the time that we create those structures. But those structures are very old at this point, right? I mean, biology as a separate discipline has been around for quite a long time. Chemistry is a separate discipline, been around for quite a long time. And so as we learn stuff in those disciplines, right, we then start to ask new questions that are between those disciplines. And then you want to start to reorganize. But of course, you've built a university, you've built an education system around this existing thing. And it's very hard to change that then.
And I found that academics can be territorial. They want to be very specific and not go outside their purview.
Academics are human beings like anybody else.
Oh, that's right. They are human beings. You're right. We can't escape
Scientists are human, yes.
Well, so I can't help but also, because of being a news anchor, ask you about a recent news article. We've just crossed the threshold for CO2.
Mm-hmm.
And what was interesting was that part of the story that I heard on this discussed that there's an immediate reprieve this summer because the leaves are going to come back out on the trees and they're going to absorb a lot of that CO2. But on the flip side of this, what about the oxygen levels? Are they affected in this as well?
That's a great question. So CO2 goes up and down all the time in a very small amount, but it goes up and down all the time because during wintertime, CO2 is being emitted by plants that are respiring and animals. And during spring and summer, it's being pulled down.
Absorbed.
Because of blooming plants, essentially. And so, yeah, oxygen does the opposite. Oxygen and CO2 are kind of in this back and forth dance because when one goes up, the other has to go down. And so, in fact, if you measure the oxygen abundance in the atmosphere, you find it's doing the same kind of up and down thing. But the variations are much, much smaller because the amount of oxygen in the atmosphere is much, much bigger. So it's a very hard measurement to make, actually. But about 20 years ago, some folks figured out how to make that measurement for the first time. And it's something that actually is monitored regularly now.
Does it portend? I mean, I get it, but you know, I realize the whole issue in this report has to do with CO2, global warming, or
so there's this natural cycle up and down that's caused by the seasons, essentially. Superimposed on that is this gradual trend upwards in CO2. That is because we're putting more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere over time, and that's the threshold that was crossed. We crossed over this 400 part per million threshold. We're now higher than that on average in the atmosphere. And that's not a threshold that actually means anything except to us. It's a milestone for us because of the number scale that we have, and 400 hasn't been 400 ppm in, I think, 3 million years or something like that. And that's because of us.
This is up on Mauna Loa in Hawaii where they measured this, right? So it's that level up there?
Yeah. Well, carbon dioxide is pretty well mixed in the atmosphere.
In the whole atmosphere.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So Mauna Loa is just, it's a convenient place to make the measurements, and they've been making them there since the 1950s.
Sure.
So we have a long-term record, very good record. So oxygen, as I said, is doing the complement. It's bouncing up when CO2 bounces down. And as the CO2 slowly rises in the atmosphere, oxygen is slowly going down. But again, it's a teeny, teeny change. So small that it's, again, very hard to measure and too small to be of any consequence. You don't need to worry about running out of oxygen, not being able to breathe the air.
There's no way to artificially affect that? Trees, plant? I mean, is there any way to increase it?
Sure. I mean, if you plant lots more trees, you will pull the oxygen up and the CO2 back down a little bit, but you can't do it enough to make a difference
I think that's part of the thing that, you know, both lends to the folks who want to say, well, the Earth is too large for us to have any impact on it.
You know, it's an interesting question. I think we probably do have the capability of turning around if we choose to do so. I was just at a workshop a couple months ago at ASU where a bunch of us were talking about the concept of deliberately capturing CO2 from the atmosphere. And the discussion was being driven by the fact that CO2 is rising. There have been a lot of ideas and policy ideas about what we might do to slow down that rise and stop it, and, you know, having to do with cutting our CO2 emissions and all that. The reality is none of that's happening. And here we are. CO2 has now crossed 400 ppm, and it's likely going to keep on doing that.
And there's evidence now that things are changing.
Things are changing, and they're likely going to change much more. And so the whole theme of this workshop was, okay, so what are we going to do about that? This is no longer a problem that we can necessarily solve just by our restraint, because by the time we get around to restraining ourselves, there already is going to be too much CO2 in the atmosphere. Arguably, there already is now. So what can we do to actively pull it out of the atmosphere? And that's maybe where we need to be thinking. Instead of worrying about restraining ourselves, we also need to do that. But maybe we in addition, need to be thinking about how we could actively capture carbon from the atmosphere.
You know, in all these world destruction movies, they have the scientist and the president.
The mad scientist, usually.
Usually. Or, you know, a passionate scientist, usually. And someone who has found out something and wants the world to know.
Oh, those movies, yes.
So my question to you is, for example, we've interviewed the scientist over at Cornell and talked to him about some of their climate models and looking at the Northeast and how the climate will begin to change. But he tended to back off this passionate argument, you know, and stuck with the science. All of this conversation we're having is wrapped up in politics. There's no way around it. You have to get legislation passed or movement through politics. So do scientists need to be more strident in the end if we want to reverse what you're talking about?
That's a really interesting question. Do I really want to go there? I'm not sure.
I wasn't sure you would.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think we have a responsibility as scientists to be much more engaged in the conversation in ways that we can contribute to uniquely. I think that's very important. I mean, I'm not an economist. I don't feel comfortable giving a congressman advice on what policies we should follow from the perspective of making sure that the economy keeps on growing, right, even as we ratchet back CO2. So an economist says, well, you can't do that, the science says, because that's going to kill the economy. I can't argue with that very well, except on a values basis. But I do know a lot about the atmosphere and what's happening. And I certainly understand the climate science well enough to be able to make some powerful statements about that side of it. And I think all of us have a responsibility to be engaged. But that's not the same as being strident. I mean, what I think has concerned me is that a lot of scientists, and for all the right reasons, but have gotten involved really in specific policy arguments and advocating for specific policies that have all sorts of ramifications beyond just the science. At that point, the scientist is no more qualified than the bricklayer to be commenting on kind of policy topics that have real economic complications.
And it's probably multiple solutions to the problem.
And there could be multiple solutions. But I think we have a big responsibility. And I think the scientific community in general probably doesn't do as much as it should to be engaged. I would say it's not about stridency, it's about engagement in a useful way with the public.
That was Dr. Ariel Anbar, a biogeochemist in the Department of Chemistry at the School of Earth and Science Exploration at Arizona State University. He was speaking with the Best of Our Knowledge's science reporter David Gustina as part of our astrobiology series on the origins of life. Our coverage is made possible by the NASA Astrobiology Institute through support from the New York Center for Astrobiology, located at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York, in partnership with the University of Albany, the University of Arizona, and Syracuse University. To learn more about all of the topics in our astrobiology series, go to origins.rpi.edu. Well, since we spend so much time looking for oxygen on Earth, it seems only fair we spend time with water on Mars. At least that's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. Recent missions have greatly increased our knowledge of Mars, but have we even scratched the surface? Deanne Rogers, assistant professor of geosciences at Stony Brook University, explains why finding what we are looking for may require a little digging.
Did Mars ever have lakes or oceans? Concentrated salt deposits at Meridiani Planum, a vast dune-covered plain spanning over 600 miles in diameter and investigated by the NASA Mars Exploration Rover over the last decade, point to repeated episodes of groundwater rising to the surface and rapidly evaporating over 3.5 billion years ago. The minerals found by the rover suggested highly acidic waters, though, and in limited amounts, not conducive to life. But what about elsewhere? Why would groundwaters only emerge on the surface in Meridiani Planum? Groundwater flow models suggest that waters may have risen to the surface in other topographic lows, such as basins formed by meteor impact. So why not look there? Using infrared data from a NASA satellite, we have found evidence of water in one of those basins, but this time the minerals point to mild water conditions, perhaps similar to hard tap water on Earth. What's more, layered materials found in the crater point to deposition underwater. So unlike the Meridiani Planum salts, these minerals were formed in a lake, standing water that did not evaporate rapidly enough without first filling the bottom of the basin. Where did the water come from? There are no channels leading into the crater that would suggest river flow. The water must have come from below. For the past two decades, the search for habitable environments on Mars has been focused on locations at the surface due to limiting sensing capabilities of satellites and rovers. But on Earth, nearly 50% of the total biomass is comprised of microbial life found underground. With increasing evidence for extensive groundwater on ancient Mars and harsh conditions at the surface, perhaps we should be looking for signs of life way below the rover's wheels.
That was Deanne Rogers of Stony Brook University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.